Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. So last evening, I was preparing for this week's conversations, and I usually explore the internet and different magazines and publications I receive, looking for interesting, pertinent, and timely conversation pieces. A piece that came on the Guardian's website struck my interest. It was called "Back to the Land, Are Young Farmers the New Starving Artists?" it asked. Oh boy, I thought to myself as I delved deep into this article that was actually released just yesterday, so it's hot off the presses. As I read through it, I realized the objective of the article was to detail that farming and farmers don't live a glitzy nor glam lifestyle that's cracked up to be, especially for those more young folks who are intrigued by the latest back to the land movement, as they described it in the article. Granted, we've had numerous guests and experts from diverse fields come on our show to explain what they are doing to deal with the starry-eyed idealists who want to farm. But those experts, they try to describe the realities, the risks, the challenges, the benefits, the rewards, and the potential for farming tomorrow. The experts also focus on solutions of change, and not more about the perils, and not more about the expose, which again is a bit of what we see from mainstream media, and in no different from this article in the Guardian. The teaser line in the article states that a small but growing movement of millennials are seeking out a more agrarian life, but the reality of life on the land isn't always as simple as they hoped. They describe a young woman farmer named Liz, who is their depiction of a young farmer with some of these buyer's remorse associated to her choices of going into farming. She sought more meaning in her life, and that hasn't necessarily panned out to her expectations in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. I'll just say, the article is fine. It's worth a read if you're intrigued in the stuff, or it's more of like the same stuff that we've seen out there. One nugget that I did pull out of this, what I thought was interesting, came from their proposal that farming was like the starving artist, and those next iterations of the back to the land movement, things don't look so good, as they stated. That, yes, we have challenges, so probably it's not for you. But to help solidify this point, or maybe to belittle the context of the movement, or surely an expression of their lack of understanding of the need and the appreciation for this, the author details that this back to the landers, as they described, equivalent of what Bernie Sanders was dismissed, as millennial farmers today may be, as unrealistic dreamers. Hillary Clinton, long before her presidential matchup with Sanders, dismissed the movement as mental masturbation, an interesting exercise in philosophy, but not a way to live in the world. So quite interesting to hear that from perspective. Many problems here. Most of it begins with the narrative we decide to use, of course. Today, we welcome a guest who will be able to share some insight on the future of farming and a modern back to the land movement, maybe a modern back to the soil movement. We welcome acclaimed author David Montgomery to episode 58 of Sourcing Matters. Hey, David, how you doing today?
I'm doing good, Aaron. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I welcome the opportunity. I am a reader of your books. We had a chance to meet in person a few years ago, and I know our listeners will welcome the opportunity for us to chat. So, David, let me do this. Let me ask you the question about that preamble. So is this another iteration of the back to the land movement? Is it just a fad for more ideologues? And if so, as Hillary explains, aren't we just screwing ourselves?
Boy, you know, there's a lot of sort of layers to that onion to unpeel, in that I think that, you know, some people will never find fulfillment no matter what they're doing. So, but I've been very impressed in the last few years not so much about the back to the land movement, but the movement to rebuild and regenerate the soil, to essentially heal the land, what you might call it, the heal the land movement, and how that's catching on with farmers who are already established, who used to be conventional farmers. But back to the point of the preamble, I mean, here where I teach at the University of Washington, our students a few years back started a farm on campus because they didn't like how some of the food was being grown for their in the residences that they were living in. And we don't have an ag school. We're not a land-grant university. We don't have a soils department. And there was a huge interest among the undergrads in getting into sort of urban farming and having that kind of a thing on campus. So I think that that idea of a back-to-land movement is a real one, particularly among millennials. But I see it as just sort of a single facet, if you will, of how society at large is starting to look at the practice of farming and the practices of farming and reconsider some of the things that we now do conventionally that in a broad historical sweep are actually pretty recent inventions and have had some consequences that weren't really intended. You know, and the reality of today is that farmers can grow a lot of food on fairly small plots of land, and so that most of us don't have to farm. Whether there's, you know, what's something like 1% of the American public are farmers, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, that was flipped. It was like, you know, 90%+. And I don't see that changing. So that there's a lot of room for folks to want to get back into farming, to get into farming, and the problem of how we get young people interested in carrying on farming is actually a huge one for society, because you look at the average age of farmers in North America, and it's pushing 60, and we need people to be running the farms to actually be able to grow food for everybody. So we do have to figure out ways to make farming attractive to a new generation, but not everybody has to do it.
I think you did a wonderful job in your book, Growing a Revolution, talking about some of those farmers that were once mainstay conventional farmers, some other new folks that were involved in the farming iteration, where we're developing or maybe reconnecting with this operating model, this regenerative operating model, which again, I'll point out the article in The Guardian didn't necessarily describe that was one of the big differentials between what some of these young early stage farmers are focused on or interested in is this more inclusive or systems thinking approach of our agricultural models and in our health and environmental health. So let me do this if I could. I'm going to read a quick preamble about Growing Revolution and then ask you a couple questions specifically about that book. And we'll jump into some of the other books that you've written as well.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, in book Growing Revolution, you introduced us to farmers around the world at the heart of a brewing soil health revolution that could bring humanity's ailing soil back to life remarkably fast. Cutting through standard debates about conventional organic farming, you explore why practices based on the principles of conservation agriculture help restore soil health and fertility. Drawing on visits to farms in industrialized and developed worlds, you find that the combination of no-till planting, cover crops, and diverse crop rotations provide a profitable recipe to build soil organic matter. Farmers using these unconventional practices cultivate beneficial soil life. They smother weeds, they suppress pests, while spending far less on diesel, fertilizers, and pesticides. So, David, if you could share a bit with our listening audience some of those interesting farmers, ranchers, and producers that you met while researching your book and some of the lessons you pulled out of that.
Yeah, well, the background to sort of why I went around looking at that is that I had worked for a long time in my academic life as a geologist on the problems of soil erosion and land degradation. And it's been sort of a major, relatively silent factor that has affected human societies for a long time. And if you think about the problem of feeding the world of the future, you know, if we continue to degrade the farmland that we depend on to grow our food, it's just going to get harder and harder to feed more and more people. So that's sort of the background to why I went and spent some time visiting with farmers around the world who had restored fertility to degraded farms, who'd taken their farmland from, you know, maybe a couple percent organic matter up to 5, 6, 8, and in one case even about 10% organic matter, really restored fertility to their land, and had done it as a consequence of intensive farming, sort of making money all the time, you know, while doing it, but restoring health and fertility to the land. And their stories really intrigued me. So I visited folks down in Costa Rica and coffee country, people in equatorial West Africa, in Ghana, and across North America from the Dakotas to Pennsylvania and Ohio and up into Canada. And those factors that you mentioned, the sort of the idea of combining no-till with cover cropping and a diversity of rotations, that was the common element that people on, you know, large farms in the Dakotas, you know, 20,000 acre farms that were growing crops for the American commodity markets, or coffee plantations in Costa Rica, or small subsistence farms in Ghana, they all shared the adoption of those sort of three principles that they implemented in really different ways. You know, the practices that they were using in the Dakotas were not the same as what were being used in Africa, of course. You need different scale, different climate, different kind of soils, totally different crops. But those guiding principles all really worked. And so in visiting those folks, I came away very impressed that we really need to think about the soil as the foundation for how we farm in a very different way than we taught farmers to do it for most of the 20th century. And if you think of those three principles, the you know, don't disturb the soil, keep it covered with cover crops, and plant a diversity of crops, those three principles are 180 degrees the opposite of what we have adopted as what we adopted as conventional practices during most of the 20th century, where we used intensive tillage with large amounts of, you know, agrochemicals, fertilizers, and pesticides, and grew one or two crops, functional monocultures. So I became convinced as a result of visiting these folks who had really restored their land and done it remarkably fast. I became convinced that we could fundamentally transform agriculture by reorienting how we think about the soil and how we look at the practices that we adopt. And I turned into a bit of an optimist about being able to do that when I saw that the reduced cost for diesel, the reduced cost for fertilizer, the reduced cost for herbicides or pesticides really made a big difference and made these regenerative or conservation agricultural practices economically viable. They paid off profitably for the farmers who adopted them. And that's a recipe for growing adoption and spreading of ideas. So, I mean, I could go into the details of some of those individual farmers if you'd like to talk about them in more detail. But the generality was that these regenerative principles, practices based on regenerative principles, really seem to work and provide a good opportunity for aligning environmental improvement with economic development and improvement.
Yeah, so let's pull that thread a little bit on the economic side. So the knock on this, or many people's perspective, is it's not economically feasible. You on your coast, me on my coast, well, sure, we got people with the resources to pay for these type of products, but the producer can't afford that. That's one of the, I'd say, one of the misnomers out there around regenerative agriculture. And in your book, you can give an example of one of those farmers that were able to address those misnomers through the economic modeling and looked at it differently, giving you hope and optimism.
Yeah, I mean, there's farmers like there's a gentleman named Gabe Brown in Bismarck, North Dakota, he's one of the people that I visited who really made the case that when you restore fertility to the soil and increase its organic matter, you don't need to buy as much fertilizer. You don't need to buy as much herbicides. He's not using herbicides anymore. He's not using pesticides. And those savings that one gets from those costs, as well as from having gone no-till, there's less diesel to purchase because you're driving the tractor across fields less often. If you can spend less on the inputs that modern conventional farming tends to rely on as a replacement for healthy, fertile soil, if you can then still grow the same amount of crop, have a comparable yield, but you're spending less to grow it, you're actually better off economically as a farmer. And what Gabe basically demonstrated is that he can grow crops for less than his conventional neighbors. He can also get a price premium for it when he sells them at farmers markets because of the perceived higher quality of what he's actually growing. But the reality is that it doesn't cost more to produce. He's able to get a price premium on it because the demand is there. So the conclusion I came away from writing Growing a Revolution with is that if most farmers adopted regenerative principles, the cost of food would actually come down, not go up, because you can't get a price premium for something everybody's doing.
Hmm. It seems that a lot of the challenge in that is all of the systems are built, or maybe the man-made systems in modern U.S. especially, are built around conventional agriculture. All the support systems, all the infrastructure, all of the input providers, they're all mirroring some of these input-based and extractive-based agricultural models. And it does seem that the consumer may be the one that's going to have to drive change here. Did you find that in your research, or even in your collective research as you've put the book out a couple of years ago now, have you seen a drastic change in where consumers are headed in appreciation and understanding and also demand for these types of products?
I think that's going to be a big driver of what helps move the regenerative agricultural bar forward. I think there's sort of two drivers. One are the economics for individual farmers, that it can actually pencil out for them. The people who are advising them on how much nitrogen to purchase and how many inputs to use aren't going to be benefiting as much if people buy less of their products, but the actual farmers would probably benefit more. So that's, I think, a big driver there. But consumers, as you're identifying, I think is the other big potential driver. I've seen a lot of growing interest in people wanting food that's grown from healthy, fertile soil. There's a lot of talk about whether or not food grown with regenerative practices is more nutrient dense, is essentially healthier for us to eat. Having more minerals or more phytonutrients, chemicals made by plants that our gut microbiome ferment into beneficial metabolites that help support our immune system and our health. And there's scads of them, and there's good evidence to suggest that farming practices affect both the mineral density and also the phytochemical density of plants. And that's a book that Ann and I are actually researching at the moment. Ann Baclay, my wife, who wrote The Hidden Half of Nature with, about microbial life and its role in soil fertility. We're working on a new book that looks at the role, the degree to which soil health translates into human health as mediated by our farming practices. And I think as people look into this and digest the research, and there will be growing consumer demand for higher quality, healthier food grown on in healthy soils. And I think that combination of on-farm economics and the potential for growing consumer demand is really going to help spur practices to be adopted more widely. And I've had conversations with some fairly major food companies, shall we say, that are very interested in being able to identify their products as regenerative because they see a growing future demand. So, I think that consumer demand is one of those big things that is going to help with this. And I think that this phenomenon of regenerative farming is a good example of how environmental interests and economic interests and health interests can all coalesce around a single objective. And there's lots of facets of society that will then benefit from that.
And the comparison or the connection to soil health and human health, microbiome health, it seems, and I'd love to get your perspective on this, because when it does seem like a no-brainer, when the consumer understands that their personal well-being, the well-being of their children will be significantly better if they eat healthy soil, if they eat nutrient-dense food from good, healthy soil, they could just cut the food out of there and start eating the soil.
Maybe a little bit of soil is okay, but not a steady diet of it.
That's a heavy roughage. But if they are able to do that, and really the key seems, how do we quantify that value on our health? It's such a complex system, and there are many moving parts. How are you going about trying to quantify that information?
Boy, it is a really hard thing to try and nail down if you're looking at, trying to quantify it in a very tight manner, in part because think about how you would connect understanding soil health to human health at the moment, where you walk into a grocery store, And the food in there is from all over the planet. So, you know, what was the soil like that any of that food was grown in? You don't, as a consumer or a researcher, really have that information when you walk into a store. And then if you look at how different each of our own gut microbiomes are, and that because they're the workers that will be processing that food, it's incredibly diverse. So it's a challenge, but there's been what you essentially have to do, and the way that Ann and I are working on that for the new book is that we're looking at the studies that are available to look at sort of each of the connections along the chain that goes from healthy soil to healthy crops to healthy livestock, and then the healthy crops and healthy livestock into healthy people. And I think probably the best way to look at how sort of nutrient-rich or nutrient-dense food grown in healthy, fertile soil plays into that is thinking about essentially preventative medicine. There's you know, some foods have cancer-fighting properties and things like that that could help in terms of treating maladies. But I think the real power of a diet of healthy food grown in fertile soil is more in terms of supporting one's immune system, supporting one's body. It functions at a higher level to essentially maintain and promote health. In other words, as preventative medicine is, I think, where the big sort of lever in terms of not only what we eat, but how we grow it lies. And it's really hard to demonstrate what those effects are at a population scale when you can't connect people to the land that their food is coming from anymore. So it's basically an exercise in trying to look at what are the medical studies that connect things like what do different phytochemicals and plants do to human health, the sulforaphane in the brassicas and broccoli and cauliflower, stuff like that, for example, has demonstrated cancer-fighting properties. Okay, well then, how do farming practices, how do regenerative versus conventional practices, or organic versus conventional, influence the expression of sulforaphane in that crop? And you can go down to the list sort of for other crops, and you can also look at how changes in the life in the soil affect the ability of plants to acquire the mineral micronutrients that we need them to have in their bodies so that we can get those minerals into us or into the livestock that we eat, and how do farming practices affect essentially the flow of elements from the soil particles into plants so they can start their journey to us. And that's where the way farming practices affect nutrient density comes in. So what we basically have to do is think at a system scale, but then divide the problem up into the connections all along the way, and then line those studies up and to try and assess, okay, how much of the way that we treat the soil could we expect to translate into how good our food is for our own bodies?
David, I'm going to read a little more of your background and bio, and then I'll take us back in the Wayback Machine to talk about some of the other work you've done. So David Montgomery is a MacArthur Fellow and Professor of Geomorphology at the University of Washington. Talk about burying the lead here. I'm 25 minutes in. I'm just talking the fact that you are a MacArthur Fellow. Now our listening audience perks up and say, this guy really knows what he's talking about, which you do. He is an internationally recognized geologist who studies landscape evolution and the effects of geological processes and ecological systems on human society. He is an author of numerous scientific papers and has been featured in documentary films, network, cable news, and a wide variety of TV and radio programs and a podcast called Sourcing Matters. Now I want to discuss those other elements of it, which is really looking at the other books. And I think it was interesting you had mentioned Growing a Revolution made you an optimist. And I think looking back at some of the other work that you had done, we did this analysis about your first book called Dirt, which is the plight of soil and what we've done since the dawn of agriculture, probably a very negative impact of our process of managing our natural resources. And then, as you mentioned, the hidden half of nature, which is revealing the exploration of how microbial life underpins the health of our soils and even our own bodies. So when I saw you speak a few years ago at the Grass-Fed Exchange in upstate New York, I believe you defined yourself as, and I might be getting this wrong, but something along these lines of an anthropological geologist. Am I wrong in saying that? where you studied the history of man through soil and geology? Or maybe I put it into my own context of that.
I can embrace that label. In writing the Dirt Book, I very much got into looking at the effect of how people treated the soil affected the ability of the land to support their descendants. And so it's looking at the soil and agriculture and societies, civilizations as an integrated system of interactions was what that book really looked at. And so, yeah, that sort of falls under that label, I think. when I started writing that book, I thought it would be a great excuse to, visit ruins in different parts of the world and to think about the kind of things I'd seen in my practice as someone who studies the evolution of landscapes, of which soil is like, that's the here and now part on the surface of it, how I could write about that, and it would be an interesting thing to look into how soil erosion had shaped societies. What I ended up writing was a history of farming, because it turns out that one of the major impacts of farming practices around the world has been the degradation of soils over the long run. And that's had profound impacts on society after society that I sort of went through and looked at the archaeological evidence, the soil evidence, the history, and connected those dots to look at how ancient societies had fared when they didn't treat their land well. And it's a pretty sobering story. You can go around the world and almost tell the same story in different contexts time and again, starting in Mesopotamia and then to Greece and then Rome and then the southern United States and then the Dust Bowl. And then we're, to a geologist, we're basically virtually modern when we get to that point. And I struggled really hard with writing the last chapter of the Dirt Book because it's very easy, looking in hindsight, to have a very depressing view of the potential for us to solve the soil degradation problem in the future. And in a very real way, our modern addiction, which I think is the right word, to fertilizers and agrochemicals really arose out of not just the need to feed a growing population, but because we had so degraded the fertility of the land in Europe and North America that we could get a big boost in production by supplementing it with elements that had been depleted from the native soils. And I really came away from writing that book sort of wondering, okay, how will we manage this problem this century? And dove into thinking about things like how we could get no-till organic practices and no-till practices to work together, because up until fairly recently, no-till has been dominated by large herbicide use. The invention of GMO crops tolerant to glyphosate really helped the spread of no-till farming. But the kind of things I learned writing Growing a Revolution really turned me into an optimist that we can wean ourselves off of the chemical intensive approaches, rebuild the fertility of our soil, because I visited farmers who'd already done it. They've sort of demonstrated that it's feasible. We just have to think differently, adopt different practices, and for one of the first times in history, really, I think the long-term interests of society in maintaining the fertility, the native fertility of the land, its innate capacity to grow food for us, are lining up with the short-term economic interests of farmers, because they get a benefit by rebuilding the organic matter, by rebuilding soil fertility, which also happens to put carbon in the ground, take it out of the atmosphere and put it in the ground, where it won't stay forever, but if it's in the ground, at least it's not in the atmosphere. And the potential to do that lines right up with our need to restore fertility to the soil as a way to revolutionize farming in terms of what I like to think of as a soil health revolution that's kind of brewing away in the minds of farmers and on the fields across not just America, but around the world.
Hmm. David, we have a lot of listeners, folks that are within the regenerative agricultural space or some kind of a differentiated production model, people that care about elevated standards in food. We have people that speak this vernacular. But mm-hmm. I think some of the things that people run into are individuals, whether they're in their family or across the board or within their professional career, that become a bit of an antagonist for the way that things are now. And in fact, going back to the article that I had mentioned in The Guardian, I found it very interesting. So I went down and I look at those articles, and I always go to the comment section. And I like to peruse through the comment section to see what people are talking about. You know, no doubt that there's some interesting perspective. There's some people selling products, but you get a lot of the feel for what people talk about. You've got, you know, there's discussions of access to land, access to capital. How do you get to markets? Also, there's concerns about GMOs, the influence of big business, government subsidies, organics, all over the board. And then you would have those antagonists that would come in, probably many of them hired guns from larger players, just telling you that everything's absolutely fine with Big Ag. Don't worry about it. The impact on our soils that we have is minimal. It's no problem. And we are looking for the best sustainable impact in practice. So how do you go about dealing with those antagonists? How do you take a deep breath, keep yourself calm, and let them get away from maybe kind of an ideology in your persona or how you're looking at even a political stance on things, and make it a conversation that we're in this together?
Well, I tend to sort of like to go back to the data and look at the science that underpins stuff, but there's also sort of an attitude that I tend to have is just don't feed the trolls. You know, so I tend not to respond directly to things like that. And we get some on our Twitter feed. You know, Ann and I are active on Twitter with at Dig2Grow, Dig2Grow, if folks are interested in seeing the stuff we come up with or share. And every now and then something will come in, we just like, palm goes to the forehead going, oh no, this kind of perspective again. The idea that say that, we fundamentally need as much nitrogen fertilizer as we use today or we'll all starve. You know, you can walk through that and parse it and just go demonstrate why, no, that's not actually true. Half the nitrogen we use doesn't even get into a plant. So we could cut it by 50% if we figured out more efficient ways to deliver what we're delivering to plants already. And there's a much more efficient way to do it, and it's called soil organic matter. It's like a drip filter for nitrogen for plants, if you have the soil life and the microbes. And I think that there's the big thing that kind of underpins where a lot of that kind of antagonism towards regenerative agriculture comes from are from folks who have not really, I think, fully internalized what the message of a lot of the science in the last 20, 30 years in terms of understanding the role of soil ecology in the cycling of nutrients within healthy, fertile soils, where that actually leads one to think. And there was a great graph that I think it was Alan Franzluber's was showing at a conference I was at a couple weeks ago, where he's looking at a plot of they'd run experiments, and I think it was in North Carolina, looking at the testing sort of optimal crop yields. So putting aside the sort of food quality issue for a moment and just looking at the conventional metric of success or yield, which we need to rethink in terms of, as our only metric, but even taking that, if you plotted the amount of nitrogen added, synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, and looked at the optimum level for yield as a function of how much organic matter was already in the soil, what you see is a very clear trend where the more organic matter there is in the soil, the less nitrogen you need to hit the optimal target, which is basically, confirms everything I was writing about in Growing a Revolution in terms of the value of healthy, fertile soil in letting farmers use less nitrogen and thereby lower their expenses for that. And what I thought was very telling on Alan's graph was that the sort of zero intercept for, like, if you have no soil organic matter, the amount of nitrogen that is optimal was basically what was being recommended by the extension agents from the land-grant universities in that region. And so it's like, right, okay, so if we have very degraded soil, we need that kind of an agrochemical system to support high production. But what if we fixed our soil? We could completely change the model. So in terms of dealing with the cynics or the skeptics or the trolls, whichever framing they're in, I think that the best way to deal with them is to essentially collate the evidence that we know, go back to how we understand the way the world works, and go back to the science. Because I think a lot of what we've been learning in the last 30 years really supports the science supports why a regenerative model actually works in terms of rebuilding soil biology. because the chemistry and physics that we spent the 20th century teaching farmers to really utilize are really important. But the biology, the microbial ecology, is the part we're now starting to figure out how to operationalize in terms of cultivating the beneficial life that can help us wean ourselves off of our agrochemical addiction in modern agriculture. And I think there'll be huge side benefits that come from that for human health, if only from reducing pesticide use, but also I think from the value to society at large in growing healthier food. You know, the biggest lever may be changing what we eat, so we eat fewer sugars and processed foods and more more whole, fresh foods. But it does matter how they're grown as well. And again, that's what Ann and I are trying to pull together in the book we're just starting to work on.
Continuing that, so the book that you are beginning to do research on around the soil health and into human health, do you see those as trigger points for getting, going back to our beginning of the conversation, we're talking about young farmers. This is the future workforce. We're not going to get anywhere unless we have people that are implementing the right operating system. So do you feel that soil health and human health is that trump card that will get more folks engaged in this?
Boy, I hope that recognizing that connection will raise sort of awareness and make people sort of question, okay, where should agriculture go in the next 50 years? You know, what balance between what we now consider conventional practices and regenerative practices should we be seeking to achieve at a societal level? And I think there's a lot of individual motivations that will come into who decides to go into farming. And it is a real challenge, I think, to try and figure out ways to encourage and support young farmers to go into the field, because we need people to be doing that. And if you think about the way to grow the most food possible, just the sort of the classic problem of feeding the world, it's having more small farms, because you produce more food per hectare on a small farm, small diversified farm, than you do on a large monoculture. And I view it as the sort of the problem of trying to merge the ancient wisdom of things like crop rotations and a diversity of rotations and the integration of animal husbandry and cropping with the modern technologies of, say, precision agriculture and no-till and the implements we have now that people back in Thomas Jefferson's day didn't have. And getting those two things lined up, I think, could open the door to making smaller farms more profitable, which could get us to the point where more young people could feasibly go into it. One of the takeaway messages for me visiting farmers around North America was just how much of a capital investment there is in running a farm for the land, for the equipment, for the seeds, for what you need to operate it, and how small the margins are. The farmers are kind of squeezed between their ability to produce an awful lot of food, which depresses the price. We pay less now for the food that we eat in terms of our average incomes than probably at any time through history. But farmers are increasingly dependent on increasingly expensive nitrogen, patented seeds, herbicides, pesticides, all the sort of devices of modern agriculture, if you will. The prices of those things in real dollars have not been going down. They've been going up, and farmers have been squeezed in the middle. So that's one of the things that makes me optimistic about regenerative practices catching on, is that what a farmer can do is they can adjust their practices. They can't set the price of fertilizer. They can't set the price of the grain of their crops that they'll get in the marketplace. They can manage what they do to their land. And so I think that there's actually sort of a liberating power, if you will, for farmers in taking a new, hard, fresh look at the nature of their practices. And I think from what I've seen of the people who've adopted these regenerative principles, it works. It pencils out.
And I think it's an exciting opportunity, maybe an innovation economy for future farmers. If we do look at this, as you had mentioned, what we're talking about, that we pay the least amount for our food, but our healthcare costs are the highest of anywhere in the developed world. So
yeah.
If we do get to that point of coaxing in those values, those other attributes of what healthy soil, healthy food really does, and it becomes, to your point, preventative healthcare, boy, really cheap food becomes pretty inexpensive at that point.
Yeah, and if we could, if you look at the nature of the Western diet in terms of our consumption of simple sugars, simple carbohydrates, you know, a lot of simple sugars, that is a major source of public health issues. And if we start looking at the food system as it's connected to the healthcare system and our own health, it will lead us to thinking about not just maybe trying to shift the Western diet in ways that would make us all healthier, but also shift Western agriculture that would make our food healthier for us.
Hmm. David, where can our listening audience learn more about your current work, the three books you have out, and the future work coming out on soil health and human health?
Well, Ann and I have a website. It's digtogrow.com, dig2grow.com. And there's descriptions of dirt, of the hidden half of nature and growing revolution on the website if people want to sort of like look into it and see if, oh, do I want to read this? Then the books are available, you know, through your local bookstore, the usual online places. And we're also fairly active on Twitter with the handle @dig2grow. And those are all places that one can engage and find out more about us and what we're doing. The new book, you know, it's going to take us, you know, 9 months to a year at least to write it. It'll be out probably in a year and a half or so. Provisionally titled "What Your Food Ate," but you know, sometimes those things change as they move through the publishing system. But so far, we've been working on lining up who will visit, who will interview, and reading all the background studies to try and figure out just how well one can actually connect that linkage between soil health, crop, and livestock health and human health. And it's going to be interesting. Every time we write a book, we learn a lot, and we learn more than we sort of thought we were going to when we started it. So it's a fun process.
That is a fun process, and I'm sure it's rewarding for many reasons. And even if, as you said, it changed your perspective and gave you hope on things, well, that in itself is worth its weight in gold, as is soil. So, David, good stuff. Thank you so much. I'll also just mention, you know, I usually don't give too many endorsements for books or for things that people are coming on our show to talk about, but I do often recommend to folks that want to get into regenerative agriculture to get a better understanding of what soil is doing and that see that this is the future wave of farming and eating. I do recommend Growing a Revolution, actually, to many different folks at different speaking engagements, purely because I believe it's one of the best and most current and freshest books out there.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. I will close by just adding, folks listening, don't forget to eat your soil, but do it through good food, right? That's the key thing. So.
You got it.
Yeah, that's good stuff. David, I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation. I always learn a great deal when talking to you, and I know our listening audience will as well. So I'll just say, until next time, thanks again.
Hey, well, thanks. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Until next time. Cheers.
Bye-bye.